Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be having a chat about Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor of China. You may not have heard of this bloke before, but he, I'll tell you this, he is an enormously important figure in Chinese history. He got a lot done during a pretty bloody brief reign. You know, he established this imperial system of government that sort of ruled China for the bulk of the next 2,000 years after having unified these sort of warring, scrapping factions, kingdoms, states, whatever you want to call them, in the era before the Qin dynasty here. Pretty bloody monumental achievement, you have to say, you know, unifying an entire nation of people. Never mind, establishing a political system that's going to span the next two millennia. It's hard enough to keep your bloody bedroom tidy for a week. Never mind, you know, setting something in going that's going to last 2,000 years. You know, in addition to his lasting legacy, conquering and politicizing and doing all this other stuff, he also did all sorts of other things while ruling to sort of advance and improve ancient China with roads and canals and infrastructure and legal reforms, all sorts of boring nonsense that we will touch upon. Unfortunately, we do have to get through the boring stuff as well. But I'll tell you what, the really good stuff comes from when we talk about some of the other things that happened to this bloke and some of the stuff he was into, because I'll tell you this, he was a bit of a character. You know, he was a bit of a character, and some of the stuff that happened to him, oh my goodness, you're gonna have to, I'll get to it. So let's get stuck in and we'll have a chat about what this bloke Qin Shi Huang was all about. And before we go any further, I do apologize to anyone who is, you know, going to take umbrage with my almost certainly incorrect pronunciation of all these Chinese names. I really do my best. I went and, you know, even looked at like pronunciation video. Oh, didn't just look at them. That wouldn't help too much. I listened to them as well. These pronunciation videos on how to say names like Qin Shi Huang. But I'm going to stuff it up. So I apologize in advance. I really have done my best here. Anyway, we are going back a long, 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 long way here. We're going back to the 18th of February, 259 BCE. So, you know, over 2,000 years ago here. And it's then that our mate Qin is born. Although, interestingly, we're not 100% sure on his parentage. His mum was definitely this lady named Chao Ji, right, who had been a concubine of a bloke named Lu Bu Wei. But as for his dad, it's not 100% sure who his dad is, because officially his dad is King Zhuang Xiang of Qin. And the story goes that after Zhuang Xiang here, he claps eyes, right, on Lu Bu Wei's concubine Chao Ji. He bloody fell in love with her. Fell in love with her straight away, he did. And Lu Bu Wei actually gave her up as a concubine so they could get married. Now, here's the thing. She might have already been pregnant to Lu Bu Wei when this happened. And so when she gives birth, there's actually a level of uncertainty as to who the father was. And obviously back then, they didn't have access to, you know, the rigorous and comprehensive paternity tests, for example, that, you know, you'd see on the Maury Povich show. So this conjecture about whether or he was an illegitimate child or not has sort of raged on throughout history. But the whole thing may have just been a big hoax sort of developed years later, you know, so as to disparage and sort of tear down the reputation of Qin. But, you know, honestly, who cares? Anyway you slice it, he's born on the 18th of February, 259 BCE, as the elder son of Lady Zhao, and officially, at least, this bloke who would go on to be King Zhuang Xiang. He's not born Qin Shi Huang, this young bloke. He gives himself that name years later, as we'll discuss. So for the meantime, we're going to be calling our hero Zhao Zheng. That was the name that he had as a younger fellow. Now, his daddy eventually becomes the King of Qin, one of these kingdoms that's fighting for supremacy in a period that's very appropriately named the Warring States period. Very inventive name, well done, historians, of Chinese history. And he's a big fan of Lu Bu Wei and actually makes him chancellor, but doesn't stick around for long, because after 3 years on the throne, he dies in 247 BCE. So the dad of our mate Zheng here, he's dead, he's off. And young Zhao Zheng, who is just 13, right, becomes the king. But obviously he's very young, so he has Lu Bu Wei act as his regent for the time being. Now, Lu Bu Wei, he's a little bit worried, however, because obviously Lady Zhao, she's back to being single, and I'll tell you this, she's bloody loving it. She is loving it. She's chatting up blokes left, right, and centre, having a great time. She's even going after Lu Bu Wei, and he's got no interest in being caught, you know, getting caught jumping into bed with his boss's mum here. And so he comes up with a plan to keep her busy, even though, you know, she used to be his concubine. He's not interested anymore, and he wants to go, well, bloody, I got to take care of this lady, because otherwise, you know, there's going to be trouble if young Zhao Zheng finds out. So he hilariously decides that, and this is not a joke, this all happened. He decides that the best way to keep her occupied, to keep her happy, right, would be to find a bloke who was packing some real heat, if you know what I mean, and introduce her to this bloke once he found her. So he gets this fellow whose name is Lau Ai, who by all accounts, it looks like he might have had a real monster on him, to be honest. And Lady Zhao is understandably quite taken with this gentleman Lau Ai. I don't want to get too sort of graphic here, but apparently when we talk about Lau Ai, this bloke, he could use it as an axle for a carriage wheel. It was that bloody big. One of his party tricks was to put a like an actual carriage wheel on it and wheel it around like he was. Yeah, so you're getting a sense of you know exactly how this was going. Anyway, even with this sort of girthy monstrosity, it wouldn't be appropriate for Lady Zhao, who is obviously a noble, to be knocking boots with this bloke Lau Ai. So she and Lu Buwei, they come up with a plan for a way to get him a little bit closer to it. Eunuchs were a very big thing in China at the time, and having a eunuch as a servant obviously wouldn't be a problem for Lady Zhao because there's not going to be funny business there. So Lu Buwei got someone to falsely accuse Lau Ai of a crime that had castration as the punishment. So Lau's going, what's going on here, mate? I'm quite proud of it. You know, I don't really. I mean, you better bloody bring a chainsaw as well here because you're gonna have a real problem otherwise, right? But he doesn't know that Lady Zhao has actually paid off the bloke whose job it was to castrate people. That was a real position back in ancient China. It was a real position. Imagine coming out, you know, home from a day at work at doing that job. You know, rather than sort of being balls deep, you'd be deep in balls. Anyway, the end result is that Lau Ai, he ends up avoiding having his boys lopped off there, thankfully, and instead he becomes the personal servant of Lady Zhao after getting, obviously, the Lord Varys treatment and having all his hair plucked out and his beard and eyebrows and whatever else to make him look like a proper eunuch. Now, they obviously got on pretty well because even the fact that he was supposedly a eunuch, Lady Zhao then sprogged out two sons to Lau Ai. And at this point, you might be thinking, why are we talking about this bloke so much? Where does he come into the story of young King Sheng here? Well, I'll tell you this: big fella Lau Ai, he gets a little bit too big for his boots, as well as obviously too big for his undies, it seems. And he decides that he wants a bigger slice of the pie. He's going around talking about how he's rooting the king's mum and all that, calling himself Zheng's stepfather, and all sorts of nonsense like this. And one day, in 238 BCE, he loses the plot completely, and he attempts a coup d'etat. He attempts a bloody coup d'etat against the young king here in the capital, while King Zheng, you know, he's off away somewhere. And his plan is to get rid of Zheng and plant one of his own sons on the throne instead. And this, I will tell you now, it doesn't end very well for Lau Ai. King Zheng hears of what's happened, and he dispatches two generals to deal with it. And I will tell you what, they bloody well deal with it like a plasticine animal on the hydraulic press channel. They kill all the rebels that Lau Ai had raised. Unfortunately for them, they don't manage to capture Lau Ai himself, but no worries, says the young king. Go ahead, why don't you blokes go ahead and whack a 1 million copper coin bounty on that bloke's head. That should do the trick. We'll get him in here quick as winking. And sure enough, it's not too long before Lau Ai is caught and dragged before King Zheng. And here, Zheng shows the beginning of a pretty bloody mean streak. I'll tell you this. He has three generations of Lau Ai's family executed, including his two sons, who were put into sacks and beaten to death. Even his own mum himself, Lady Zhao, you know, never mind that, you know, she sort of brought him into this world. She's stripped of her titles and locked away for the rest of her life. And Lu Buwei doesn't even escape the king's wrath here. He's implicated in the coup, and so he's exiled far to the south, where he eventually commits suicide rather than, have his fate meet up with him later on. But as for Lau Ai, well, mate, honestly, I don't know if you even want to know what happened to him, because it is pretty bloody grisly. I'll tell you that. King Zheng, he has Lau Ai ripped apart, right, by five horses. And every single one of the sources that I read through about this whole thing were remarkably specific about the number of horses being five. Now, you'd think four, right? Obviously, two, one for each arm, two, one for each leg. That's four. So it sort of makes you wonder what the fifth horse was attached to, doesn't it? Anyway, dealing with this ancient Chinese Ron Jeremy wasn't the only thing that young King Zhen had to deal with, however, because he, sensing the opportune moment, is getting on the front foot and leading the Kingdom of Qin to victory after victory against the other warring kingdoms. He is doing a bloody great job. Now, there are seven states in total. Calling them kingdoms apparently is incorrect. I don't understand exactly why, but there are seven different states, nations, kingdoms, whatever you want to call them. There is the Chu, the Wei, the Qi, the Yan, the Zhao, the Han, separate, not the same as the Han dynasty that would come later, different thing, Han with a little sort of spiky bit above the A there. And, of course, the Qin, ruled by our mate Zheng. Now, Zheng gets on the front foot, as I say. He conquers the Han in 230 BCE. Again, not the Han dynasty from years later. And he moves on to the Zhao in 229, which is made easier by the state of Zhao getting hit by an enormous earthquake and then a famine. So a bit of a 1-2 punch. And then here's the third one as well coming around the corner from Zheng as he cleans up in Zhao. Next on the docket was the state of Yan, which he had been preparing to invade for a while. And finally, you know, he's looking like he's going to get around to it in 227. Now, remember, we're BCE here, we're before the Common Era, so we're counting backwards. 227 is closer to us than 230, for example. Now, Yan was a tiny, bloody, puny little kingdom it was, and it definitely couldn't stand up to a full-scale Qin invasion. So as a result, the son of its leader, Crown Prince Dan of Yan, which is a truly excellent name, he says to himself, bugger this for a joke, I know how I can stop this bloody invasion, mate. I will have that bastard Zheng assassinated, no worries, and that'll stop those Qin buggers in their tracks. So Dan of Yan, he gets two blokes named Jin Kei and Qin Wu Yang, right? And he hatches his plan with the aid of a disgruntled Qin general, Fan Wu Ji. And I've called this guy disgruntled, and I'm immediately realizing that probably isn't the most accurate adjective to use in this situation. He's a fair bit more than disgruntled, as you'll understand in a minute. Fan Wu Ji had turned traitor against the Qin, not a particularly, you know, wise move, but hindsight is 20/20 here, because he's now got a price in his head of 1,000 gold coins after having, you know, sort of done the old Benedict Arnold here against the Qin. So here is the plan that Dan of Yan puts together, if you'll believe it. In order to gain access to King Zheng, Jin Ki is going to go to him with the head of Fan Wu Ji so as to collect the bounty, like a bloody Iron Age Boba Fett. He's going to get the head of this bloke, Fan Wu Ji, with his bounty on, right? And he's going to go and present it to the king and that way get an audience with him and from there try to kill him. The only problem is that getting the head, you know, obviously he needs to get the head of Fan Wu Ji, as at this stage it is very firmly attached to the body of Fan Wu Ji, which is a bit of a problem. But this needs to be unbelievable. Fan Wu Ji says, no worries, fellas. You can just go ahead and lop that off. I don't need it. I'm not really using it. I don't need it all that much. You can go ahead and chop me head off, take it along to the thing, get that king dead. Don't even worry about it. He had such a grudge against the Qin after having betrayed them, after turning traitor. He hated the Qin so much. Imagine being so disgruntled that you're happy to commit bloody suicide just to help someone assassinate a bloke you don't like. I mean, look, I understand having a vendetta against someone. I certainly do. When I was about 5 years old, Gene Keogh took a massive chip that I've been saving out of a bag that I was eating, and I was severely disgruntled. I'll tell you that. I've never forgiven Gene. I was severely disgruntled when he took this massive chip. I was saving it to last. I was looking forward to eating it, and he just snatched it out of the bag. I was very disgruntled, I would say. But in the intervening 25 years, I have become at least slightly regruntled, you know, and I now live in a state of general gruntledness. But being so disgruntled that you're letting people chop your head off, I think that's less gruntled than I've ever been in my entire life. I think it's fair to say. Anyway, the deed is done, and Fan Wu Ji's head is, you know, chopped off, presumably with a big smile. He can't believe his luck. He's just happy to be there. After that, Jin Ki and Qin Wu Yang, they head off to seek an audience with King Zheng. And, you know, they've got Fan Wu Ji's head as a gift for him. They are given, you know, pretty bloody speedy access to the king, who's very keen to see what's going on. Now, they've wrapped it up in a map of the area that Zheng is hoping to capture. A very nice touch, very sort of fertile farmland area that was owned by the Yan there. And, you know, obviously pretty nice touch to you know, wrap the head of this bloke in something that the king was after there. And before long, they're granted an audience. Now, Jin Ki and Qin Wu Yang, they head into the king's chamber, and all of a sudden, Qin Wu Yang, he starts bricking it. He's paralyzed with fear. He's so nervous. He realizes what they're about to do, and he's, mate, I'll tell you what, he's crapping his dacks with fear. He can't believe it. Now, Jin Ki has to make some pretty quick persuasion checks here, but he goes with the line of, please excuse my simple friend. He's never seen such royal majesty before. He's awestruck in your presence, you know. Now, despite sounding like something out of a very bad action film, it actually works, and Jin Ki is allowed to present King Zheng with this head. Now, when the map unrolls, it reveals that there is more than a head waiting inside this little package. However, Dan of Yan had planted a poisoned razor-sharp dagger in there, and Jin Ki grabs it quick, smart. He grabs it quick as lightning as anything, and he lunges at the king. But Zheng is too quick, and he ducks away, and so the dagger only rips through his sleeve. Now, so far, so good. We've got a pretty standard, serious, historical moment, an assassination attempt that, you know, it would make for a very dramatic piece of cinema, for example. You can imagine the gravitas of the situation, this mighty king having this young, this assassin leap at his throat like this. But unfortunately, that's where it ends, because the rest of it, honestly, sounds like it would have been an appropriate scene in an Austin Powers film. Check out what happens as this assassination attempt unrolls. What happens next? Ridiculous. The king, King Zheng, he has a sword on his belt, but it is meant, basically it's a ceremonial sword, meant for only for ceremony, and it is really, really long. It is so long that he can't get it out of his sheath to defend himself. On top of that, none of the other people in the room were armed. Imagine this. You're the king and you don't have any armed guards in the room with you. What are you doing, mate? I mean, come on, get your head in the game. You got a lift here, mate. And so the rest of the people in the room, they can't stop Jing Ki from chasing Zheng around the room. Zheng ends up running in circles around a pillar, trying to get away from Zheng. Have you seen that? What is it, a duck chasing a dog or something, or a rabbit or something? It's chasing it around this sort of this tree, trying to get around like that. I just imagine these two idiots running around a circle, playing Ring Around the Rosies here, while Jing Ki's trying to, you know, get him with a very deadly game of tag around the size of this pillar here. It's absolutely ridiculous. But finally, one of the blokes who's there, a doctor, comes to his senses and chucks his medicine bag at Jing Ki, knocking him off balance. Now, Zheng cannot draw this bloody sword. He cannot get it out of its sheath, you know, until he finally listens to what the people are yelling at him and he realizes how he needs to do it. He needs to reach over the back, witcher style, and pull it out from over his shoulder. Now, Zheng finally gets the sword out and he gives Jing Ki a mighty chop on the leg and he falls to the ground. Now, Jing Ki desperately chucks the dagger at Zheng, but he misses and Zheng bears down on him and fills him with more holes and a bloody sieve, mate. Qin Wu Yang, meanwhile, has tried to flee, but he's caught and ultimately killed by the guards. And so Zheng survives his first assassination attempt, a real coming of age for any young king or any young emperor there. He manages to survive this attempt, but... You did hear me mention that it was his first, and yes, revered listener, there were a number of others as well, which we will get to in due course. But that's the end of Jing Ki. He gets, obviously, as I say, he leaves with a few more holes than he entered with. I think it's fair to say he's, you know, a little bit more perforated after this whole experience. And as for the state of Yan, after this, Zheng just went right ahead and invaded it, completely crushed it into the dirt. And the king of Yan, a bloke named Shi, he even tried to appease Zheng there by having poor old Dan of Yan put to death. Imagine that. He puts his own son to death in order to try to, you know, forestall this invading army. But our merciless friend Zheng didn't care at all. Didn't care at all. And Yan was utterly annihilated by 222 BCE. So after having dealt with the Yin, King Zheng is still getting on with the business of conquering. Obviously, he moves on now to the Wei and the Chu. Now, Wei falls when he marches 600,000 troops towards the capital, besieges it, simple as anything, and then redirects the flow of a nearby river to completely flood the city, which killed about 100,000 people altogether. Absolutely brutal. But look, you know, it doesn't really matter how he got it done. He got it done, and ultimately, the kingdom of Wei, or the state of Wei, falls. Chu, on the other hand, was a little bit more difficult. Now, at this stage, one of Zheng's generals, Wang Xian, he insists that they need 600,000 soldiers to take over Chu as well, right? But Zheng goes, mate, you need to get it done with 200,000. You know, it's the end of the quarter. We're all feeling the pinch. We've really got to tighten the belts. You know, we got to sort of, you know, just knuckle under. It's crunch time. We got to get it done here with you know, a little less than we'd like. Now, Wang Xian goes ahead and he resigns over this. He's not going to be treated like an idiot. And Zheng, he goes, all right, well, you know, whatever. Don't even worry about it. And he marches on anyway. And he gets pummeled into the dirt by the Chu. Oops. Yep. Didn't see that one coming. 200,000 men, not enough to capture the kingdom of the Chu. So after this, Zheng, he goes back to Wang Xian and he says, look, sorry about that, my old mate. Turns out you were right. Did need all them troops after all. You did. You should have listened to you there. And now, not giving him the old I told you so must have been the hardest thing to resist. But Wang Xian is gracious and he accepts the king's offer to come back and lead the troops again, this time all 600,000 of them. And by 223 BCE, Chu has also fallen. Good on you, old mate, Wang Xian. Get the job done. Bloody legend. Now, at some point during all this whole thing, I actually couldn't find the exact date. I'm interested to know exactly when it was, but I couldn't find exactly, you know, in which year this took place. But there's another assassination attempt on the docket here for Zheng. He has to deal with another assassination attempt. You know, he's getting a bit sick of them by this stage, obviously. This time, is it was at the hands of a different bloke. Obviously, it wasn't a spooky spectral ghost coming from beyond the grave with trying to get him from that. No, it was a new bloke named Gao Zhanli, who was a friend of Jin Ki and wanted to avenge his death. Obviously, Jin Ki, the first assassin who died. Now, again, mate, I understand holding grudges and I understand seeking vengeance. I'm still plotting my retribution for Gene Keo and his thievery of my chip. But trying to murder the most powerful bloke this side of the Silk Road doesn't seem to be the smartest move, honestly, here. Anyway, he's dead set on getting it done, is our mate Gao Zhanli here, generally. So he figures out how he can gain access to the king. As it happens, he's a very, very talented lute player. Ancient Chinese bloody Jimi Hendrix over here. And King Zhen is a big, big fan of music. He loves a tune. He does. So Gao Zhanli, he goes around performing and playing for people until the king hears about him, hears about his prowess, and so invites him to come and play for him personally. Now, Gao Zhanli, he goes along determined to find a way to assassinate Zhang, but, oh no, bloody disaster. He is recognized once he turns up for this performance, this recital, before he goes in to see the king. He is recognized by one of Zhang's men as a friend of Jin Ki. Gao Zhanli had been in incognito, been using a fake name and all that sort of stuff. He'd been incognito until then, trying to avoid all the reprisals of Jin Ki's friends and family that they sort of suffered after the last time there. But he's found out. He's found out he's revealed as a friend of Jin Ki. Now, never let it be said that King Zheng is not a wise and merciful ruler. Very, very wise, very, very merciful. And even after finding out who Gao Zhanli is, he still wants to hear him play his music. He still wants to give him a chance. And so as something of a compromise, therefore, and a very, very reasonable compromise it was too, Zheng only had Gao Zhanli's eyes ripped out of his head so as to blind him. So very, very reasonable indeed, you have to say. Now, I didn't find any first-hand evidence of this. It is fair to assume that Gao Zhanli probably wasn't a huge fan of this development, but all the same, he played the lute for the king, and Zheng bloody loves it. He bloody loves it. He's that good at plucking away on those strings, and he goes, you know what? You can stick around for a while because I do like you. I love the way you play that lute, so I'm all about it. So he ends up having Gao Zhanli stick around for quite a while, relaxing his suspicions of the bloke as he sort of earned his trust, playing for the king there. And this was a very nearly fatal mistake because Gao Zhanli had not given up on his quest to assassinate the king, and he'd started to smuggle bits of lead into his lute, turning it into this big, heavy bludgeoning weapon, basically. Once he's ready and his lute is sort of more of a club than a music instrument, Gao Zhanli plays for King Zheng, getting as close as possible while doing so. He's really getting up, he's having a great time, before finally spinning his lute around and taking a huge swing at Zheng with his mighty, big, massive, weighted lute. And, of course, he misses by miles. In case you forgot, he was blind. He couldn't see and, didn't even come close. Twist ending. You're never going to guess how this one ends here. Gao Zhanli was very messily executed for this, and King Zheng then became even more concerned for his personal security, and so there were no more assassination attempts for a while after this. But we're not finished with him just yet. As all the wars of unification that Zheng is fighting, they'll rage on, they'll crack on throughout this whole sort of period, And the very last state to fall was the Qi in 221 BCE. And I'll tell you this, they hardly even put up a fight, honestly. With the fall of Qi, there was nothing left for Zheng to conquer. He'd captured every last scrap of territory that used to be part of the old kingdom of Zhao. And as a result, he decides, sits down to think about it, and he decides that he's had enough of kingship. He has now decided that he is in the empire business, and he becomes the first ever emperor in Chinese history. And as a result of this, young Zheng, he actually renames himself. He renames himself Qin Shi Huangdi, which means first emperor of the Qin. Now, taken more literally, Huangdi actually means shining or splendid. So Huang means shining or splendid, and Di was an old high god. He actually invented this title, sort of combining terms with Chinese mythology. And it went on, check this out, it went on to be used by Chinese emperors. Huang Di, you went on to be used by Chinese emperors right up until the final abolition of the imperial government. And you're never going to believe when that took place. That was in 1911. Over 2,000 years, people were using this title Huang Di, invented by this bloke Qin Shi, right there. So he's got it done with this, establishing this enormously powerful office, political office there. And he got it done after reunifying all of these warring factions and states and whatever else. Anyway, his name did get shortened a little bit to what we know it as today, as Qin Shi Huang, by historians, sort of historians from back then as well. And that's how we know him today, as I say. Back then, however, he this wasn't the only name he had. He had a whole bunch of names. He called himself the Immortal after a while, which I don't want to ruin the ending of the podcast here today, but ultimately was, unfortunately, false. And it was forbidden for anyone to call him Zheng anymore. He made it. It was just taboo to use his old name that he'd used when he was a king. And check this out. This is the most ridiculous thing. He made it illegal for anyone other than himself to use a first person pronoun. You couldn't say I or me anymore. The only person who was allowed to say the words I or me in Chinese, obviously, was this bloke, Qin Shi Huang. He was the only, he'd sort of cordoned off I and me, the first person pronouns, just for himself to use. And everyone else had to use, well, something different. As far as I could understand it, this actually meant that people had to start using a different word when wanting to use a first-person pronoun. And even today, the word that they use, woe, that it actually replaced Zhen, the word that he took for himself. So they still use this word woe that after, you know, 2,000 years ago didn't mean anything, right? They had to make up a new first-person pronoun because of Qin taking the other one for himself. It's kind of like Queen Elizabeth coming out and saying, all right, here, listen, you bloody filthy peasants. Only I can say the word I now. All of you lot, you've got to start saying J instead. It makes no sense whatsoever, but that is the way that it went. It all sounds a bit bonkers. And for the good reason, it just definitely is bonkers. And the good news is here, my friends, the good news is there is plenty more bonkers stuff coming down the line here. Plenty, plenty more bonkers stuff coming your way. But for now, however, we've got to wait the historical Brussels sprouts of Qin Shi Huang's story, and we're going to get through some of the boring stuff here. Take a quick break. Talk about, I don't know, just boring history stuff for a while before we cut. You know, we cover off what Qin did once he'd secured his position as emperor. Because I tell you this, he definitely did get a lot done in a pretty short period. China, at the time that he took the throne, the imperial throne, it was feudal, had a feudal system of government, but not anymore, says Qin. He abolishes it. He abolishes feudalism and he chops up all of the states and kingdoms that he'd conquered into new administrative regions, ignoring previous hereditary entitlements, national alliances, whatever else. He organized it the way that he wanted to. China was very, very heavily regionalized at this point. These divisions did a lot of work to undo this and focus everyone on belonging to one empire, one people. He standardized a bunch of stuff throughout the entire empire, significantly language and writing, so as to do away with regional dialects and scripts. And, you know, he tried to standardize that throughout his entire realm there. And on top of that, weights and measures, currency, even stuff like the length of cart axles, so road widths could be, you know, consistent throughout the entire empire. He even, if you, this is, again, you know, you sort of think, okay, all that makes sense. That's very sensible. Good on you. You're good on your chin. You know, you're making some good decisions here. But he always has to do just go the one or two steps further to just get slightly into the realm of the insane here, because he even standardized the lengths of the hats that people would wear. Utterly ridiculous, but apparently back then you had to wear a hat that was exactly 15 centimeters long. That was the standard hat length back then. Anyway, I don't know. On top of all this, the reforms, political and social and whatever else that he did, on top of all of that, he put in some real hard yakka into public work projects, mate. He was honestly like a bloody Animal Crossing mayor. He's getting out there, getting it done. He connected two of the major rivers running through China, the Xiang and the Lijiang, right, with a canal that was 34 kilometers in length. It's called the Lingkou Canal, and it is still there today. It connects the Yangtze and the Pearl River basins, an enormously advanced feat of engineering, especially back in those days, and it's still used today. It's this sort of, allows you to take this enormous inland route that's nearly 2,000 kilometers long, all the way from Hong Kong up to Beijing. It's quite amazing. And, you know, we can put the canal aside at one moment, because while it's impressive, certainly doesn't come anywhere close to his second major achievement. You may have heard of this little engineering project that he kicked off. It wasn't known by this back then, but today it's known as the Great Wall of China. Back then, obviously, wasn't really great, but the mediocre wall of China doesn't really have the same ring to it. Now, in fairness, it's not the wall that stands there today, most of which was built after the 14th century, but Qin was the first to start putting up an enormous unbroken wall to prevent barbarian attacks and invasions from the north. All the states had sort of little scrappy bits of defences facing north there like that, but Qin said, nah, bugger that, we need one big, long, enormous bastion from one end to the other to prevent people from getting in, and that's what he did. So quite an astonishing achievement, especially, you know, we're talking 2,000 years ago. So, on top of all this, politically, he was a proponent of Chinese legalism, which I am not intelligent enough to understand because, to be very honest with you, there is no simple English Wikipedia page on it. Seemed to have a very heavy focus on law and order, which makes sense given its name. It, you know, exactly what it says on the tin, I would imagine. You won't be surprised to learn that as a proponent of legalism, he wasn't a huge fan of dissent. He even went so far as to burn books of all kinds, principally political and historical books that could be used to compare him against other rulers. And I have to say, you know, on a quite a serious level, I'm definitely not joking here, definitely not a fan of this. Really, really not a fan of this. Burning books has to be one of the most horrific and ignorant things, one of the most historically damaging actions a person can do. There is absolutely no justification for burning books of any kind, and I completely stand against it in any form. Anyway, that look, you know, we've had enough. We've had enough of this boring nonsense. Let's get back to all the idiotic stuff, all the crazy stuff, because, you know, obviously that's what people tune in for, right? That's what people tune in for. We've eaten the Brussels sprouts. Time for a big scoop of chocolate ice cream. So let's kick things off with another assassination attempt. A very, very, this one, potentially, no, not better than the other ones, because honestly, you know, I still can't get this guy trying to pull a sword out while running around a pillar with another bloke slashing at him with a knife. I mean, that's, you know, that's a hard one to top. But another bloke came close. Another bloke came close in 218 BCE, an aristocrat from the former state of Han. This bloke named Zhang Liang, right? He sold everything he owned and he hired an assassin to kill Qin. This assassin was this huge, big, muscly bloke, huge, big, you know, sort of circus performer, strongman he was. And for some reason, Zhang Liang decided that the best weapon for him to use to kill the emperor was, of all things, a massive metal cone. Zhang Liang had this cone made. It weighed almost 100 kilograms when it was finished. Absolutely ridiculous. I mean, what? Just, use a sword, mate. Use a bloody big rock. Why does it need to be a cone? I don't know what's going on here. Anyway, he and the assassin, armed with, you know, again, what was perhaps the most impractical assassination weapon in history, laid in ambush waiting for Qin. Qin was on his way over a mountain in a carriage, or more specifically, in a convoy of carriages. Zhang Liang and his mate, they're hiding there in the bushes and they're, you know, peeking out, having a look. Oh, here comes that convoy. And they've spotted the richest and the most finely decorated carriage in the entire convoy. They go, that's where he is. That's obviously, you know, he's in that. That's the emperor, the imperial carriage. That's where he's hiding. We're gonna take that one out. So richly decorated carriage goes past, the assassin jumps up, chucks this massive cone at the carriage in question, and, you know, just smashes it to bits. Now, of course, this assassination attempt is unsuccessful. Our boy Qin, he's no fool. He wasn't in the richly decorated carriage, was he? No. It was a decoy. He was safe and sound in another one. And so the third and final assassination attempt was unsuccessful. Zhang Liang actually, he got away with it too. He went on to do all sorts of stuff to kick off the Han Dynasty, but, you know, that's another story. So 3 from 3, he's done pretty well, has our mate Qin there. He's got out of it. But again, I mean, if you're going to assassinate an emperor, I mean, I definitely don't condone this kind of behavior. I definitely don't condone any kind of assassination. I mean, not just of emperors, of anyone. Use your words. Use your words. But, you know, if you can't use your words, definitely don't use a 100-kilogram metal cone to try to kill someone. I mean, don't kill someone in the first place. But if you have to, don't. But if you really do have to, don't use it. Don't use a 100-kilo. What are you thinking? Don't use a 100-kilogram metal cone. Come on. Anyway. Perhaps due to all these, you know, assassination attempts, Qin was actually, he was completely terrified of dying. He just could not come to terms with his own mortality. And as he sort of got on later in years, you know, even after all the good work he did with conquering and reforming all that stuff, he started sort of get a bit, you know, he started going a little bit bonkers at the end there. As he got into his 40s, he started to put some very serious time and effort into finding the fabled elixir of life. Now, obviously, you know, Nicholas Flamel wasn't around back then, so he had to sort of go asking in other areas, most of which, as you would expect, just absolutely wacko. He visited a place called Zhifu Island, which was said to have the Mountain of Immortality on it. He actually went there 3 times and left inscriptions on the stones there. On his second visit in 218 BCE, he left the inscription, "Arrived at Fu and carved the stone." So, you know, very, very, a man of few words, it has to be said. But on his third visit in 210 BCE, 8 years later, I should say, he obviously had a very exciting time indeed. He left a very detailed record of the stuff that he got up to on this island. It says, "Came to Fu, saw an enormous stone, and shot one fish." So that is the, you know, highfalutin lifestyle of the ancient Chinese emperor, shooting a single fish and looking at big rocks. On top of this, he also sent his court sorcerer, I wish I had a personal sorcerer to go and do my bidding. Bloody hell. Anyway, he sent off his court sorcerer, a bloke named Xu Fu, off on a mission across the seas to find, again, the Mountain of Immortality, this massive big mountain, Mount Penglai, I think its name was. Now, he wasn't sent alone. Oh, no. He was sent on ships with 3,000 virgin boys and girls, which I don't know how they were going to aid him in finding this mythical mountain, but that's the line that he took. So, yes, I presented to you without comment, I suppose. So, as I say, they're off looking for this mountain, Mount Penglai, a mythical mountain where, you know, all the buildings are gold and platinum, the jewels grow on trees, and the fruit there grants you immortalities and cures disease, whatever else. Now, we don't know conclusively if Zhu Fu ever found Mount Penglai. He never actually returned. he may have just continued sailing east until he hit Japan and sort of, you know, settled down there with his massive squad of virgins and colonized the place. We really don't know. But what we do know is that all of Qin's attempts to find immortality were ultimately completely unsuccessful because he died. I mean, shocking. I know. Sorry to kind of ruin the ending there, but yeah, he died. In fact, it's actually interesting because his search for immortality may have been what ultimately led to his death. He was reported to have been taking mercury pills, thinking that they'd extend his lifespan. Oops. And as a result, Emperor Qin Shi Huang fell seriously ill while on a tour of eastern China and finally died on the 10th of September, 210 BCE, at the age of just 49. However, after having died, his corpse was still a two-month journey away from the imperial capital. So the story doesn't end here. The imperial capital, Shenyang, is, as I say, 2 months' journey away, and his advisors realize that they might have a bit of a problem on their hands, because if people find out that the emperor was dead, there might be this, might be an uprising, might be a common uprising, or, you know, a coup, or an attempt of who knows what. You never can tell what these filthy, lowborn peasants can, you know, never can tell what they're going to do, can you? And as a result, Qin's prime minister, Li Si, he decides to hide news of Qin's death. And as was so often the case during Qin's life, even after death, a ridiculous pantomime surrounded him as he made his way back to the capital. Li Si only told a very, very few number, a very small number of people the truth about the emperor dying, and he loaded the corpse up into this carriage and set off back to Shenyang with everyone in tow. Nothing going on here, boys. Don't even worry about it. We're all fine. We're just going to get the emperor back home. However, he ordered two wagons of rotting fish to be drawn alongside the imperial wagon, one in front, one behind, to mask the smell of his decomposing corpse. Certainly nothing suspicious about that, you wouldn't think. Nothing fishy. Well, actually, a lot fishy about that, but, you know, nothing suspicious about that. No worries. Meanwhile, they brought food and drink and fresh clothes to the quote-unquote emperor throughout the entire journey, and then relayed messages from, again, quote-unquote, the emperor to the rest of the entourage. You know, you just didn't come out and say hello to anyone, which maybe wasn't particularly unusual for Qin there. But they managed to hide the fact that he was dead all the way until they made it back to Shenyang. They then announced the death of the emperor, who was eventually succeeded by his 18th son, Qin Ershi. He had a lot of kids. He had about 50 kids through, you know, from all his concubines and wives and whatever he had. He was a very, very busy bloke by the sound of things. And his 18th son became the second emperor. He was supposed to be succeeded by his first son, Fu Su, but Li Si, who didn't like Fu Su, check this out, forged an edict from Qin Shi Huang ordering his son, Fu Su, to kill himself. And bizarrely, he did. My dad had a hard enough time getting me to polish my shoes before going to school, never mind bloody offing myself, but Li Si managed to trick the heir apparent to the throne, right, the heir apparent, to kill himself because his dad told him to. I mean, honour thy father and thy mother, by all means, but there is a line. There is a line. Anyway, the story of the next emperor, Qin Ershi, it's another one entirely. And it's not a particularly happy one, I'll tell you this. Within a few short years, unfortunately, the empire that his dad had built was crumbling. The Qin dynasty was not in safe hands. And, it gave way. It fell apart. It gave way to the Han dynasty that kicked off only about 3 years, essentially, after the death of Qin Shi Huang. There was the Qin dynasty completely over, more or less. Anyway, Imperial China was on its way. It was on its way. And even after the collapse of this short-lived Qin dynasty, the famous Han dynasty rose to power and ruled for over 400 years. And from there, Imperial China ticked over and over and over for over 2,000 years. A very, very long time. A huge achievement that to be established here by this one bloke, Qin Shi Huang. Before we finish for today, there's one last thing we need to cover, and you may already know what it is here, because obviously I've very deliberately left it out until I want to talk about it right at the end. We need to cover something that happened in 1974, when a group of Chinese farmers were digging a well in the back country of China, somewhere in central China. They were digging this well, and they came across, after digging deep enough, they came across an enormous, enormous underground necropolis, filled with thousands and thousands of life-sized statues of soldiers. You've probably heard of the Terracotta Army. It was discovered in 1974. This mausoleum had remained undisturbed for centuries and centuries, and these thousands and thousands of statues hadn't been seen or touched for hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years perhaps. 8,000 soldiers, 600 horses, 100 chariots, all made, all statues, of course. On top of that, you know, crossbows and traps and jewels and weapons and all sorts of things that were designed to keep the place secure. And I'm sure you've heard of it. You've seen probably pictures of these intricately detailed statues, all of which were originally painted in these garish bright colours. And this army was armed, as I say, weapons. 40,000 weapons were buried with them back then as well. This whole thing, staggeringly huge project. And you'll never guess who was behind it all. Of course, it's pretty bloody obvious who was behind it all. Apparently, when he first became king at the age of 13, Qin Shi Huang, or King Zheng as he was known back then, ordered the construction of this mausoleum, and it wasn't finished until after he died. It was under construction for 38 years. 38 years it took to build. And the whole thing, it covers more than 3,000 square metres. It is bloody huge. He definitely didn't muck about, I can tell you that. In any case, all of these amazing achievements, all of these incredible things that Qin Shi Huang did here, uniting an empire, building canals and walls, reforming an entire nation's politics, in addition to obviously all the wacko stuff, that's what makes up his legacy today. Qin Shi Huang went from the king of one of many squabbling nations to one of the most influential people in Chinese history. And now he's lying there surrounded by his thousands of terracotta soldiers to protect him from evil spirits, leaving us only today to marvel at what he achieved. And giggle at it, I guess, as well. Yes, we're definitely going to have a giggle or two. Let's be honest. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Qin Shi Huang, the first Chinese emperor. And thank you for sticking through it. Thanks for sticking with me for another episode of Half-Assed History. Certainly has been a pleasure to have you along. And a special welcome goes out to all the people who've emailed me in the last week or so saying they've just discovered Half-Assed History and they're enjoying it. Or, you know, even the ones who said they hated it. I mean, I don't know why you wasted your time emailing me, but I appreciate the feedback all the same. But welcome. Welcome. By all means, welcome. It's great to have you as part of the Half-Assed History family. Do hope you stick around for a couple more episodes. And a very special thank you to all the old listeners who are still sticking with it after all these, we're coming up on a year, which I'm very excited about, only 2 months away until Half-Assed History turns 1 year old. So very, very exciting time for me. And I really do appreciate all the support and the positivity that gets sent my way. And of course, the money. Oh my goodness. Thank you to everyone supporting and kicking in on Patreon. You can do the same thing. If you head to halfasshistory.net, you can chuck me a couple of bucks. There's no obligation to whatsoever. And there are no benefits to doing so other than, warm fuzzy feeling, you're lining my wallet there. But I really do appreciate, I can't really properly say how much it means to me to have people at my back like this. So thank you so very, very much. Halfasshistory.net also has all the old episodes. You can go there in a contact form if you want to get in touch with me. You send me an email via that. And I'm always very happy to hear from people. And I'm still sending out stickers, of course. You can get in touch with me, send your address, and I'll send you through some stickers free of charge. Not a worry at all. That's that, I think. We close the show out for today, as usual, with a question posed on Reddit here. And obviously, we've talked a fair bit about China, Chinese history, the indefatigability, the might of the Chinese Empire over the millennia. And so with that in mind, a very good question asked by Reddit historian Hamzaboy. Hamzaboy asks, if China is so fragile, then how did the country last for so many years?